Two men who know the angles, uncover and untangle all the questions and the webs left out to dangle. Be in 1962, last Wednesday's afternoon, they'll bend your ears with reckless self-abandon. The Amazing Spider-Talk. The Amazing Spider-Talk. Come swing through the air, sit back and prepare for the Amazing Spider-Talk.
Hello, I'm Dapper Dan Gavazdin, and I'm the founder and editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
And I'm mischievous Mark Giannacchio, and I'm the founder of the Chasing Amazing blog and author of 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us for the 7th episode of the all-new Amazing Spider-Talk. We hope you enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and collectors as we look at the Spider-Man comic universe in a bit of a bigger picture.
Yes, Dan. In this first season of the all-new Amazing Spider-Talk, those of you who have been on the journey so far will know that we have been taking a closer look at the Stan Lee and Steve Ditko creative run on the title. Last time out, we talked about Stan Lee and all the kind of controversies and mythos surrounding his co-creation of the character of Spider-Man. We had a great guest as well to talk us through it. Today, it's just Dan and I again, and we're going to be talking about one of Spider-Man's greatest adversaries. Maybe we'll this probably will be the center of our discussion. He's now also his brother-in-law, surprisingly, and that is J. Jonah Jameson.
Awesome. I can't wait to get into this. J. Jonah Jameson is very near and dear to me, but I have to say, like last time, we are not going to be talking about any particular issues in the Lee Ditko run. So if you want to listen along, don't worry about reading anything, but if you do want to read along with us, of course, we're reading the Lee and Ditko run, and you can find that run just about anywhere, print, digital, or as part of Marvel's Unlimited service. So go check it out. You can find out more about what we're talking about. So now sit tight, grab some wheat cakes, and prepare yourself for
Papa Jonah.
Another immortal character in the Spider-Man mythos is J. Jonah Jameson.
Oh, I loved him.
Where does J. Jonah come from?
You know who J. Jonah Jameson
who was? Who is it?
He was me.
Really?
He was irascible. He was bad-tempered. He was dumb. He thought he was better than he was. He was the version that so many people had of me anyway.
right.
And I always wanted to play him in the movie. I was so sorry that by the time the movie was made, I'm too old to play the role.
right.
Well, I don't really think I'm too old, but obviously they do.
right.
Anyhow, and the guy who's playing it in the movies is
phenomenal.
Wonderful. I think he did it better than I could have done. And that's very high praise.
That's saying
me.
A lot for you, yeah.
Anyway, I wanted Peter to have a freelance job, not a staff job anywhere, not a steady job, because I wanted him free to do his spidying.
Right.
So I figured a freelance newspaper photographer.
Right.
And then it occurred to me, I'm going to make the guy he works for. In Superman, there was Perry White or
Perry
somebody,
White.
Who was probably a nice enough guy.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want this guy to be a nice guy.
Right.
I wanted him to hate Spider-Man, because I liked the irony of the fact that he has Spider-Man working for him,
right.
And he hates Spider-Man, yet he always wants to get pictures of Spider-Man because he sells papers. Also, in those days, that was when there were hippies and so forth, I wanted him to hate teenagers, because
right.
To Jameson, every teenager was a long-haired commie prevert hippie,
right,
you know? So I got a lot of fun out of that. He hated Peter Parker. He hated Spider-Man. Peter had to work for him. Jameson wasn't a villain. He
right.
wasn't bad. He was just a bigot.
Right.
He was ill-tempered. He
right.
was. We all know guys like him.
Right.
And as counterpoint to Jameson, I wanted to get, I got a guy, Robbie Robertson, who was a black editor, and I wanted him to be the voice of reason on the newspaper. He really carried the paper.
Right.
He pacified Jameson. And I also wanted the reader to suspect that Robbie suspected that Peter was Spider-Man.
Whereas Jameson was too clouded with rage to ever make that connection himself.
Again, and you'd understand this as well as anybody, by having a family in a strip, people you know their personality, you know their character, you know, then you know how they would talk, you know what they would do. And to use that old cliche, which isn't true, the stories almost write themselves.
Exactly.
All righty, Dan. J. Jonah Jameson. I've been looking forward to this episode ever since we first started talking about the all-new Amazing Spider Talk. Just before we get into, you know, the character itself, it's kind of worth just noting a little bit of history here. You know, as you could read in 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, plug, Stan Lee definitely wanted a newspaper in the Marvel Universe, and in fact was a little hesitant, as much as he wanted, was a little hesitant because over in the Distinguished Competition, you had Superman and the Daily Globe, and the editor of that paper was Perry White, who was kind of this very professional, white-collar, you know, dignified journalist. So to kind of create a distinction from DC, Stan decided that the editor of his newspaper, the Daily Bugle, would be someone completely opposite of who Perry White is, I would say. You know, the irascible J. Jonah Jameson. Actually, also another little interesting note, Daily Bugle first appeared by name in Fantastic Four number 2. But that predates Amazing Spider-Man number 1, which is J. Jonah Jameson's first appearance by at least a year. It might even be 2 years. Obviously, once Jonah came, then kind of the Bugle itself took shape. It was more of just kind of this innocuous figurehead, so to speak, in the background in the Marvel Universe. But Stan has talked about in a number of interviews that he sees himself in Jonah. I mean, obviously, he kind of in his wonderful ways that we talked about last episode, Dan, you know, he kind of like brushes aside, well, I'm not as crazy as he is, but but he's definitely always kind of saw himself from a personality standpoint. And didn't you even confirm with John Semper Jr. that Stan Lee was in the running to voice the character on the 90s animated series?
Yeah, he really wanted to do it. And I think even when the Sam Raimi movies were coming out, there was significant talk about Stan doing Jonah in that movie. And obviously they made the right choice. But that would have been a very interesting vision. I'm not sure if Stan Lee's acting chops were up to it, or really his physical chops to kind of fill in that role, I guess, a decade ago.
Yeah, and in terms of the animated series, it ended up with Ed Asner, right? I mean, it's not like it went to some like nobody.
Yeah, and Stan would eventually appear in the series as himself, so I guess you kind of get to win in both ways.
There you go. How have you? I mean, what are some other things to kind of know about Jonah before we dive into the character in the comics itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a conversation to be had, and maybe we can get into this a little bit later, about J. Jonah Jameson operating as Stan Lee's criticism of then the modern media, which I think strangely remains true to this day. One of my favorite things is in Amazing Spider-Man number 1, Stan Lee writes, quote, "Unfortunately, if something is shouted loud enough, there are always those who will believe it." And I think it's a pretty apt criticism of a number of forces in our society, including the media these days.
Yeah, I mean, and Stan would probably have a reason to even go in that direction. I mean, considering how like Dr. Frederick Wortham kind of assault on the promiscuity of comics or whatever you want to call it kind of derailed the industry there, almost killed the industry in the 50s and early 60s. You know, and obviously because it was someone with a doctor in front of their name, it seemed like the media kind of picked up on that and ran with it and treated the comics as kind of this cult, you know, thing that, you know, strange people were into. You know, it took a while for comics to be accepted as kind of a mainstream form of entertainment by the media.
I mean, and to this day, that quote kind of defines how Jonah is portrayed in the comics. They always seem to move him into a realm where his voice is used to kind of, whether it's directly assaulting Spider-Man, but also kind of like assert his very unique opinion. So like, as reflected by today's society. So we had Jonah on the Fact Channel, which I think was clearly a stand-in for something like Fox News. And now we've got him running his own blog empire, which is kind of like a stand-in for like a Breitbart or like a Drudge Report, if you will. So, you know, Jonah has kind of always operated in that kind of like sharp critique of media role.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing too that in interviews Stan has kind of pointed out with Jonah is he's also always kind of seen him as like the square adult character, you know, the one who wants to rain on all the kids' parades. I mean, he's kind of an easy regular character to vilify without having superpowers, which will, I think, also feed into another conversation we're going to have in a few minutes about Jameson and his status vis-a-vis Spider-Man. But yeah, I mean, he, you know, there's one interview that's in my book that, you know, Stan kind of talks about how, like, you know, Jonah hates teenagers. He hates hippies. You know what I mean? Like, he definitely kind of stands as being very anti-counterculture in all its ways, and anti-youth. And, you know, that kind of, you know, it's like Mad Magazine lampooning somebody, you know?
Except for when it comes to his son, who's kind of like a paragon of good virtue.
Right.
Even when he turns into a wolf monster.
Right.
But we've never really gotten much of the life of John Jameson. I'd be curious to see, like, a story about what it was like to be raised by someone like J. Jonah Jameson, who's, like, fiercely proud of you, but also kind of an enormous stick in the mud.
Yeah. Perhaps the biggest mystery to J. Jonah Jameson is what publication was he actually in charge of when Spider-Man first started getting published?
Yeah, right, because we've got him. I mean, it changes by the panel. He's either the, like, head of Now Magazine or the Daily Bugle. And I think there's, like, some books that have both and some that alternate one or the other. And eventually Now Magazine goes by the wayside. I mean, I think it's been referenced here and there every once in a while throughout the history of Spider-Man. I guess less so these days. And there's some idea that Now Magazine is like this like imprint of the Bugle that does things like Peter Parker's photo book that came out, I guess, like, when was that, in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, yeah.
What is your take on that?
I don't know. I think it's probably just early Marvel confusion, like Peter Palmer style.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. But yeah, Now Magazine, the mystery continues.
Yes, definitely. But let's kind of get into the meat of our conversation here, Dan. You know, it's funny, when we did our bad guys, I almost slipped into my accent there, episode a few weeks ago, someone had written in and they were like, well, where's Jonah on that list? And, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, J. Jonah Jameson, I mean, has there been a bigger thorn in Spider-Man's side out of anyone? And I'm here to pose the argument, though, you know, does that actually make him a villain? You know, one of the arguments I've always seen with Jameson, is he a villain or is he an antagonist? And is there a difference? And I'm going to say that there is a difference, and I'm going to say that he's on the side of antagonists. But I want to just kind of float it to you first, and then I can get it. I can talk more specifically why I'm saying that.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. I guess it depends on how you define both, because I think you can be both a villain and an antagonist at the same time. Jonah is responsible for... I mean, he might not be the guy that's physically punching Spider-Man, although I'm certain that that's probably happened a number of times in the
right.
book.
Yes.
You know, but if it wasn't for him... I mean, a lot of these characters are motivated because Jonah has sent them after Spider-Man, particularly. I don't think the Scorpion had much of a beef with Spider-Man initially. It was Jonah who was... He just provided the money and means to send this guy after him.
Yeah.
You know? So, I don't know. I mean, it's a really fine line if you want to distinguish the two. And I don't think anybody has really, like... I mean, it's funny, because Jonah is equally supportive of Spider-Man, just not aware of it. because he's
yes.
financially supporting him, unbeknownst to himself. So, yeah, I mean, I think I would ultimately land with you that he's more of an antagonist than a villain, per se. But I think if Jonah had the means himself to take it out on Spider-Man, he would. He's just not physically strong. And when he does actually, like, let's talk about in this run, the Spider Slayer arc, it's Jonah's face and his operation that controls the Slayers that goes after Spider-Man. And I think that's where you cross the line.
Yeah. No, I definitely get what you're saying. And you know, later in the arc, too, there's definitely a shift when Steve Ditko was more in charge with storytelling responsibilities, and we can get to that in a second, so put a pin in that. But I guess for me, you know, the reason why I'm kind of making these nuanced distinctions is, you know, with a villain, especially in like a superhero comic book context, I see it, you know, I see a villain as being someone who has very large motives beyond just conquering the hero. You know what I mean? Like all of the villains in this Lee Ditko run, you know, they have confrontations with Spider-Man, but it's, you know, these confrontations come because he's interfering in larger plans, you know, whether it's kind of a world domination or just steal all the stuff or whatever. You know what I mean? It's you know, it's not until years later where villains like Venom and stuff kind of come to be just to beat up Spider-Man. So in terms of what makes then Jonah more of an antagonist, I mean, I see an antagonist as kind of, you know, an omnipresent character that's just constantly picking at a scab that is Spider-Man, you know, like it's not, because he rarely, you know, he doesn't, I guess you could argue he does get the best of Spider-Man, but he never physically gets the best of Spider-Man. And then in the same vein, Jonah is designed to never get his comeuppance. He never physically gets the best of Spider-Man because Spider-Man's never physically going to get the best of him outside of maybe webbing his mouth shut here and there.
Or flicking his tie.
Right. And you know, he just gets embarrassed and then he's out and doing his shtick again. And because I feel like in like superhero comic books are set up, like the villain has to get their comeuppance. That's just how the story arc goes. I mean, do you agree with that at all, or am I really reaching here?
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. I mean, I'm thinking that like perhaps I think it's a little different for Jonah because his expectations are different. Like, I don't think his goal is ever, you know, if I were to say he's a villain, I don't think his goal as a villain is to ever like really be physically engage with Spider-Man more than it is to kind of unmask him and reveal him for the crook that he is. So I think, like, as a villain, success for Jonah would be pulling Spider-Man's mask off. And he's certainly gotten close a number of times. But you're right, he's never really landed a substantial blow other than writing some editorials that would, like, make Spider-Man the villain of New York. So, yeah, I guess it is a more, like, omnipresent – force in Spider-Man's life than like a real direct immediate threat to him. Except for, you know, I keep returning to that Spider-Slayer story.
Right.
Where Jonah, you know, his goal is to restrain Spider-Man and then ultimately reveal his face before the camera.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, and let's also talk about the Scorpion story, because, I mean, those are the ones that I think are worth coming back to in this argument. But if I could just bring up the fact that it is kind of interesting that, for the most part, Steve Ditko apparently took over sole storytelling and plotting responsibilities around issue 10. And that's the same issue where there's this huge soliloquy from Jameson, where he's more or less kind of like, I mean, outing himself as one of the Ditko and Rand inspired moochers. You know, it's like, why do I hate Spider-Man? Because I know I will never be as good as him. You know what I'm talking about? That whole.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's a pretty epic Jonah speech. And he's just like, you know, self-flagellating here, like about how he's just can't live up to being a hero. So he's going to tear the hero down. And it's kind of like in the ashes of that foundation that Jameson kind of, I feel like, becomes a more warped, deranged character in the comics until Ditko eventually leaves the book, and then he kind of goes back to being more of just a pain in the neck. But like, it's definitely during that run, during the latter half, where he does become more sinister. So maybe part of how I'm using my, you know, making this argument is more in hindsight now, because I mean, like, even like the whole Scorpion story, that's something that, you know, just to refresh, in Amazing Spider-Man number 20, you know, Jameson essentially invests and funds the, you know, this Matt Gargan, who we knew was like, was he an ex-con? Or, I mean, he had a questionable past, right? I mean, that's kind of established in the comic.
I could have sworn he was just like a really good detective.
I thought that, you know, there was talk that, Was it that the experiment made him go crazy, or was he kind of crazy to begin with? I mean,
I'm pretty sure it was the experiment that made him crazy.
Okay, well, either way, you know, has this guy go into this like augmentation to kill Spider-Man? I mean, that's the goal. You know, that is the most sinister thing, even more so than the Spider-Slayers, because I always kind of saw the Spider-Slayers as. Alistair, is it Alistair or Spencer? I always confuse the Smythes.
It's Spencer initially.
Okay, I always kind of saw that as Spencer Smythe being like, hey, I got some cool tech here that could help you take care of Spider-Man. And Jameson's like, oh, I'm listening, you know, like. Whereas like Scorpion, it's like, no, we're gonna make you a super guy, and you're gonna kill Spider-Man. And it's like, whoa, like.
You would get that again with the Fly in a perhaps even more deranged way, because
yes,
the Fly was like expressly a bad guy.
Right. But I mean, you know, like the Scorpion thing was even something that like that would get revisited years later by Roger Stern and John Romita Jr. as kind of like Jameson's rock bottom and lowest point, and, you know, the something that he needed to redeem himself from. Of course, only after he got exposed by the Hobgoblin, but that's neither here nor there. It's just I don't know. Like, it just seems so patently absurd in retrospect to where the character kind of went after that. That, you know, I just almost wonder if this was like Ditko kind of running ideologically rampant with the character and framing him as like this like bottom dwelling moocher who, you know, because he can't. You know, based on that one monologue, you know, because he can't be the hero, he just has to destroy it. And I think kind of once he left, I mean, the Human Fly story aside, I feel like there was kind of a centering of the character that followed, like during the Romita years and then even further during like the 70s.
Well, that's really interesting that you say that, because now it's got started me thinking about how we as the audience are expected to respond to Jameson. And I don't think we're supposed to respond to him with, like, hatred or, I guess, revulsion. Like, even at his worst, you kind of always love the guy to a certain extent or want to see him be, I don't know if the word is successful, but, like, there's a certain charm in disliking J. Jonah Jameson. I think about the Brand New Day arc where he loses the bugle, and the new guy, while having his own problems, is kind of better at his job, but at the same time, you, like, the whole arc asks you to root for Jonah to, like, fight his way back into the bugle, despite us all knowing that he would do horrible things with it towards our protagonist.
Right.
And so it kind of asks you to have, like, a complicated relationship with this character. If he is a villain or antagonist or whatever, it's, you know, it's one that you're meant to like to a certain extent.
Yeah. No, I but, you know, again, you're kind of talking about Jonah post Lee Ditko, and I wonder, is this Jameson, especially kind of like from like issue 10 on until issue 38, are you actually really rooting for this character? He's really just kind of despicable. Like he's a loser in a lot of ways. Like the fact that so many of the stories kind of center around the fact that he thinks that Mysterio is Spider-Man or Electro is Spider-Man, and that, you know, and he's just like ridiculously wrong in every way. And yet here he is, this powerful person. And it's kind of like, I don't know. I feel like this is Ditko kind of pushing his ideological agenda on a character here to kind of represent, you know, a certain kind of subspecies of humans.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think the character has kind of always oscillated between the two. Like, I think now we're kind of back in that realm for the character. And, you know, and it's probably because he's been kind of pushed to represent kind of like a right-wing media fanaticism.
Right.
At the current time, perhaps similarly to, you know, Ditko's interpretation of the character.
Right.
Which is really interesting, you know, like thinking about, you know, Ditko's own beliefs as kind of a bit of a right-wing fanatic himself, perhaps not on the scale that we're seeing today. But I think the character's kind of always oscillated between these two realms. And that might really come down to where the writer draws her inspiration from, whether it's the Stan Lee interpretation or the Ditko interpretation of the character.
Right.
I've never thought about it that way before, but I think you make a really compelling case.
I do think it's interesting, like, also, like, kind of in, like, immediately following Ditko's departure, well, I shouldn't say immediately, but soon after his departure, like, the character of Joe Robbie Robertson's introduced, and that's, like, definitely meant to be a counterweight to Jameson. A very important counterweight, I would say, to kind of balance things out. Of course, if we're, you know, we're kind of getting away from the villain or antagonist argument, but I mean, maybe the character is more of a villain in this arc, the more I think about it. Maybe I'm arguing myself out of my argument.
Yeah, I think you are. Post 10, issue 10 is a substantial part of this run.
Yes. You know, the other thing I kind of wanted to talk about, too, in relation to Jameson and what is Jameson to Spider-Man, I mean, you know, you talked about earlier about the fact that Spider-Man secretly financially benefits from Jameson. But, like, this is also one of those things, like, that is so heightened and absurd that, like, it just kind of, I don't even know what to make of it. Because, like, think about the fact that, you know, in one breath, the fact that Peter Parker takes photos for the Daily Bugle of Spider-Man, sells these photos so that Spider-Man can then be, you know, vilified by Jameson. It's the most Peter Parker thing in the world. And yet, it's also the most, like, patently unbelievable thing in the world, because it's like, how is this high school teenager who has shown no interest in photography whatsoever, using like a a hobbyist camera to take action photos of himself fighting bad guys by like webbing a camera to the top of like a wall or something. Like it really does. You know, I know suspension of disbelief, but like this is insane, right?
I think the thing about that is just surprises me how long all the writers of Spider-Man stuck to that occupation for Peter. Like it eventually became the kind of thing where it's like he's doing it and feels bad about it and it's getting in the way of his studies and yada, yada, yada. But like it was one of those things that like – I mean obviously Stan Lee and Steve Ditko did not intend for or had no idea, could not fathom how long this character would be around. And so kind of did it as like a way to kind of get Spider-Man involved in, you know, the actions of the day in New York City and come up with a realistic way for him to find out information and get to that location without accidentally stumbling on something. But like it's a kind of plot point and character beat that like is just ridiculous on the face of it. And especially considering that it went on for as long as it did. And I think to get to your point about like how we're supposed to feel about Jameson, like I think if we didn't hate Jameson or didn't like kind of like want Peter to get a win on him in, like this would seem even crazier, because here we have Peter who's supposed to be kind of this like, you know, character of virtue, and his main occupation is being a thief. Really. And we talked about this before, but it is a patently absurd thing to like make your superhero be doing.
So much so that like in the Sandman fight, he like throws grains of sand into the air and takes pictures of it to recreate the fight. I mean, so not only is he being a thief in how he's making his money essentially, but like he's lying about his photos.
I wanted to ask you about all the various different, I guess, like interpretations of Jonah and I guess different eras of J. Jonah Jameson. I know we're going to probably cover a lot of these as we get to different seasons of this show, but as we're talking about Jonah here and you're getting me thinking about how he's been portrayed in the history of Amazing Spider-Man, I'm curious if like there are other versions of the character that you think kind of update this character in a way that you find interesting, because like Amazing, he's had some flexibility. I mean, he's been the mayor, yada yada yada, but like he feels very rigid, and I guess kind of purposefully so, in a way that like is not true of a lot of other characters and how they're allowed to develop and change. Like Jameson always has to kind of stick with being this blowhard no matter how many times he's proven wrong. Like, do you think that that's healthy for the character, or is he kind of just become a caricature after all this time?
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting, because I mean, there are moments where like, and interestingly enough, a lot of these moments kind of occur outside the pages of Spider-Man, where they kind of allow Jameson to be a real character sometimes. Like, I think of like Frank Miller's run on Daredevil, when Ben Urich is kind of going after the corruption story with Anton Cherry and Kingpin. And then there's this really great story from Uncanny X-Men in the 90s. I forget who wrote it, but I know Joe Mads is the art. It's during the Joe Mads art run on it. You know, there's this guy, this villain that's trying to out people as mutants and has like all this information on a CD-ROM, of course, just to date it a bit. This is the 90s. and Jameson is like, what, you think just because I don't like Spider-Man, I'm going to like do an inherently immoral thing for you? No, I'm not doing that. I'm a newsman. I go after Spider-Man because I think that's I'm trying to expose something from a news standpoint, not because I have a grudge. And you're kind of like, And it's such a 180 of what the who the character is. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, wait, I thought that's all you do is have a grudge. So like, it is funny how like other creators have kind of like short term poached the character to give him some depth, but like a Slinky, it just always recoils back to who this character we know from Amazing Spider-Man is. Like, it is odd that of all the characters in comics, this one is just allowed no growth. And it just makes the other instances where he is different so much more notable and odd. And depending on your reading of the comic, I mean, they could be good comics, but you might be thinking to yourself, but this is just not who this character is. It's absurd. So I don't know. I mean, do those count? I mean, you know, do they make him more of a character because it's happened? I mean, I don't know.
Right. You read those things and you think, like, maybe this guy's brain just short circuits anytime Spider-Man, like, comes into the picture. But then in the Spider-Man books, like, his companies fall apart with him at the head of them because of his fanaticism regarding Spider-Man. And I guess Robbie Robertson is like the kind of like best example of the, you know, alternative to that, where it's like Robbie is the kind of moderating force on this, to the point that now, like, I mean, even in an issue of Spectacular Spider-Man this week, you know, we have Jonah being kind of sent out of the Bugle because of his insane, deranged fanaticism with Spider-Man. But then, like, the next week you could have an issue of Daredevil where he's this kind of like actual respectable newsman. And even in sometimes in Amazing Spider-Man, like, again, I go back to that Brand New Day era where, like, he seems like a relatively normal guy that's on the recovery, and then he's, you know, he's never allowed to get there. He just instantly, like, rubber bands back to being just a kind of deranged psychopath with access to media. And there's a harsh comparison kind of like at the same time you're reading Ultimate Spider-Man, where this character is allowed to grow and develop and see the error of his ways to the point that he eventually is bankrolling Spider-Man intentionally, because he sees the good in what he does. It's an interesting thing to see, like, another version of him where he's a fully fleshed out 3D guy, and then this other version where it flirts with that, but then ultimately regresses him back to the same point. Did you enjoy that Ultimate Spider-Man version of J. Jonah Jameson? Is that, like, would you like to see the character go to that place in Amazing Spider-Man, or do you think he operates best as this kind of cartoon?
I don't know if I need to see that in the mainstream universe, but the same token, it would be nice to kind of, like, I mean, I guess for me, what Bendis did in Ultimate was almost too hard of a turn for the character. I mean, I'd still like to see, I guess for me, I'd like to see more of the serious newsman come out from time to time. I feel like we still get too little of that, because, like, you know, without those tidbits, you kind of, like, fall back onto what I think might have been Ditko's intention for the character, was that, you know, the character was a joke and was worthless, but kind of, you know, fell upwards in charge of this, like, media empire. Whereas, you know, even a story like, and it's kind of meant to be silly, but it at least shows that the instincts are there, like the "I cover the waterfront" from Spectacular. I mean, like, those to me, I mean, those are the bits that I'd like to get more of in, like, the mainstream Spider-Man universe about Jonah, not necessarily kind of the hard turn that we got in Ultimate.
Yeah, I agree. And I have to express, like, some kind of, like, I mean, like, personally, I would love to see him grow a little bit, because I always get frustrated, and I must admit to, like, modern stories, but, like, I thought that there was a real opportunity to give this character more depth when his wife was murdered, you know? And it seemed like we were going down that path where he kind of was developing a new appreciation for his role in the world and Spider-Man's place in the world, and his own kind of mistakes and how his life had kind of, you know, spiraled, whether it's decision to hire, you know, the Scorpion or the Spider Slayers. And in that case, that very story, both of them teamed up to kind of ruin his life in a way. You know, but then that's quickly undone. And every time we revisit the character, it just seems to be like a new lower level for Jameson, where he just keeps bottoming out. You know, like now he lost his job at the Fact Channel and he's running his own blog. Like, how much lower can this character go? And maybe that's the point, but like, there doesn't seem to be much balance there. And it kind of renders him, in my book, as like someone I don't really need to care about so much. He's just become a cartoon while everybody else has been given so much depth and ability to grow. And, you know, to me, getting into your kind of like analog that you've created between the Ditko and Lee version, I feel like we've been stuck with the Ditko version of this character for an awful long time.
I mean, do you think that has fed into why the character hasn't showed up in any movies over the last decade?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that is. I think part of that is that these movies, you know, I think the new movie wanted to get away from anything that had been done before, and I feel like the second series, like, half-heartedly wanted to do that, and also knew that, like they would get there eventually or something like that.
Right. Well, they even had him like what, get like a email from him or something, like in all caps or something in the second movie.
Yeah. And I think everybody's just terrified of recasting that character.
Right. No, I mean, understandably, but it is kind of interesting in that we're talking about Jameson and I wouldn't argue this, that he is an essential character, and yet we've now had two mainstream versions of Spider-Man that have barely, or in two of the three cases, have not referenced him at all, kind of rendering him unessential. And, you know, if we're talking about a character that doesn't grow, that doesn't move beyond, that's kind of a caricature that, you know, plays to the cheap seats and is kind of the lowest common denominator. I mean, I can kind of see how that, why we would say, oh, who needs that character? And yet, I mean, I think any hardcore, not even hardcore, any devoted Spider-Man fan would be like, no, Jameson is a core part of this thing, you know? Like, you need Jameson as part of this story. It's just, it's an interesting dichotomy that's kind of reared itself here.
I think it's also tough because, and I think definitely under the previous series before this one, like, I could very well, I think we discussed this on our review of Homecoming, I could see him showing up in the next film. Like, I think the ground has been laid for him to be this antagonist, you know, based on Spider-Man's actions in Homecoming being kind of a public nuisance, you know, to a certain degree. We'll see how it plays out in Infinity War, but, like, I think the previous producers of the film were very wary about making Spider-Man, like, a nuisance or a reviled character in those films, you know, whether it's the construction workers teaming up to help him or the overuse of the American flag throughout the movies. Like, I think they had a hard time. If they introduced Jameson, they would have to introduce the idea that people didn't like Spider-Man. And I feel like that's something the producer who, you know, Avi Arad or whoever was running those films, like, really didn't want to showcase as part of the character. And so if you just get rid of Jameson, you get rid of that idea altogether.
Well, hey, even in the movies where Jameson was there, they had a hard time trying to really show how Jameson kind of dinged Spider-Man and turned New York against him. You know, like all those, like in, hey, he's one of us. You're going to go to come through. You're going to get him. You got to come through all of us, right?
Yeah, and there's like the woman that's singing the theme song in the streets, or the woman that shouts, go, Spidey, go.
Right.
You know, like nobody seems to dislike him, but Jameson, he's more of this comic relief than anything else, and kind of like a foil for Peter in terms of like making money, but nobody's ever really addressed the full idea that Jameson is this like overriding problem for Spider-Man in regards to public support.
Yeah. And thus we're back where we started. Villain or antagonist?
I mean, if anything, his overall effect in the book is that like no one trusts Spider-Man, which is emphasized here and there. You know, perhaps not so strongly as when Spider-Man first started. I mean, like that's his overriding effect.
Definitely. Anything else? Any other last pontifications on Jameson here?
Not really. I mean, he would obviously take on many different roles throughout his life in the pages of Spider-Man. We didn't even get into the fact that he's Spider-Man's brother-in-law in any kind of detail. That silliness.
When we talk about Brand New Day, we'll get into that.
Perfect. All right, yeah, I think this is a good place.
That'll be season 8 or 9 or whatever it is.
14?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, Mark, I think this is a good place to kind of leave it off. I guess we want to hear from you guys. What do you think? Does he qualify as a villain necessarily?
Yeah, guys, you know, write in, call in, tweet in, whatever. Let us know your thoughts on this, and we'll certainly share them either on this episode or on a Patreon episode.
Perfect.
So thank you for joining us for our 7th episode of our first season of the all-new Amazing Spider Talk. Dan, the next episode's out in 2 weeks, October 11th. I believe that's following Columbus Day weekend. What is the title for that show?
Yeah, that show is going to be called Street Fightin' Spider-Man.
Woo!
It's all about the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, man.
No, we're going to be talking about what it means for Spider-Man to be a street-level superhero and how that was established during the Stan Lee and Steve Ditko run and how the title has kind of strayed from that concept over the years.
Yeah, maybe we'll actually give you guys some specific issues to read for this one.
Yeah, that'll be good. That'll be good.
Also, for our Patreon subscribers, be sure to check out our Patreon page and your podcast feed for this week's bonus episode. Last time out, Dan and I got into, this was the most pleasant conversation ever about whether or not annuals counted, intending to end this conversation forever, only to open up a fresh wound. So great. People heard my soul just decapitate itself on podcast audio. I'm sure that's a lovely thing. This time out, we're going to be reviewing Amazing Spider-Man Volume 4, Number 32, the end of the volume before Legacy, and it's a deep dive into Norman Osborn. So just remember, for $3.99 a month, the price of a new comic, you'll get access to our exclusive new issue reviews, Swarm B-Book reviews, mailbags, and Mark's Sad Sackness episodes. And then for $10 a month, you will get exclusive commissioned artwork in the mail every 6 months. What's better than that?
Not much. And I'll say, if you join our Patreon now, Mark, you and I have done about 15 bonus episodes at this point. So you just gain access to that whole library. And that's just like 15 brand new episodes for you to listen to of the show. So if you're like hankering for more Amazing Spider Talk, that's going to be the place to get it.
It's a brand new day, Dan. It's like 3 a month.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like Steven Wacker editing these things, man. Like never missing a beat.
Never missing a beat. Well, anyway, Mark, if people don't want to miss a beat regarding you, where can they find you online?
Well, on Twitter, you can find me at ChasingASMBlog, and of course on SuperiorSpiderTalk.com and on ChasingAmazingBlog.com. And of course, please order my book, 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Leave reviews for it wherever you get it. And I'll put this back out there again. If you want a signed copy, just reach out to me on Twitter or Facebook or by Amazing Spider Talk email, and I can send you a book plate in the mail that you can put on your front cover. Dan, what about you?
That sounds awesome, Mark. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at SupSpiderTalk or on my personal account at Dan Gavazdin. where I talk about all manner of things. That's not very specific, but neither is my Twitter account. You can also read all of my writing over on SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. I got a review of that new Amazing Spider-Man issue up. So if you want to know what I thought about it, you can read it there or listen to our Patreon feed. Mark, there's a particular lesson that I don't know if it's shared with Jameson. He seems to flaunt his responsibility and power quite a bit. But I think this is something that's very near and dear to your heart. So what is this lesson that we like to leave all of our listeners with?
That lesson is, I want pictures of Spider-Man. No. It's, with great podcasts must also come the all-new Amazing Spider Talk. Pictures of Spider-Man.